Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. At this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed, that's for sure. Ronnie is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You could go to www.strategicmediabooks.com and be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. He's all over this guy, all over the place, this guy. He's also a two-time Fulbright Scholar recipient to Bangladesh and Indonesia. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he'll be publishing a book titled Movers and Mavericks, which incidentally just came out. It's an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. And early next year, another book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. The book is going like hotcakes, and we're getting a lot of action from the book, and I think we're ready for volume number two. Well, tonight's very, very special guest is Mr. Louis Ferrante, author of the best-selling book titled Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. Lou Ferrante was a former associate of the notorious Deadly Gambino crime family, and by the age of 21, had netted millions of dollars for his employers. His uncanny, natural talent for management let his mafia bosses rely on his talent as a true wise guy. In his fascinating book, Ferrante brings all the mafia wisdom and business acumen together and shows readers how they can apply the mob's best practices to their own businesses. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of the mail we received over the last week or so, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there for tuning into Crime Beat. We're cracking over 100,000 listeners every week, growing by the month. There's no turning back the clock now, Ronnie. I'll tell you, we're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and a couple not so positive comments, but we'll take the good with the bad.
I think one of those not so positive was from your mother.
I don't know. I haven't been a good boy yet. This Christmas could have been. Anyway, I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making the show possible. Like I said many, many times, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we are right on track. Now, here is this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from David from Saskatchewan, Canada. He writes, where do you guys find all these great guests? Your show last week with Anthony Amore and Tom Mashberg, who wrote Stealing Rembrandts, was a great broadcast. I also enjoyed the guy who wrote The Shakespeare Thefts. My wife and I appreciate art, so it was a treat to listen to the broadcast. Now, this one is from Gail. She writes from Pasadena, California. She writes, I wonder if a lot of the museums and art galleries are showing reproductions in order to protect these priceless pieces. Rembrandts can go for millions of dollars for art-hungry aficionados. So I would think they would want to protect these paintings. Your interview with Eric Rasmussen was fascinating as well. I loved William Shakespeare in high school. Keep up the wonderful interviews. Love your show. Hey, well, Ronnie, what's going on? Are you paying people to write this stuff?
She loved Shakespeare in high school. She must have been one of those nerds sitting at the front of the class. I got my appreciation in college for Willie Shakespeare on that. I can remind our listeners, too, that our shows are archived for 24/7 listening. So if you missed the Rembrandt and Shakespeare show, which were great, great guests we had for that show, they can go and listen to them. But do you think these guys are going to put fakes up in a museum, you know, and it costs you sometimes up to $20 to pay to get in?
Well, I don't know. That could happen.
I mean, you know, there'd be a little bit of a problem, I think, with some of the patrons.
Well, there's a lot of good reproductions out there, man, let me tell you.
Yeah, that's right. Our guest talked about, you've probably got a couple in your house, right?
That's right. Yeah, I do, in the attic. Well, Ronnie Boyd, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, and tell us what you've been up to in your neck of the woods.
Right. Well, next week we have Tim Donaghy. It's a command performance. He was a former NBA referee.
Right.
Many of you may recall, who got caught up in a gambling scandal.
Yeah.
And he's going to talk about what happened to him and a little bit about the NBA and some of the problems it's got with gambling. And then the following week, which will be January the 5th, Tim Donaghy's show is December 29th, we have Wahida Clark, who spent several years in prison. And something like Lou Ferrante, our guest tonight, she became a writer in prison, and she's an urban fiction now, and she's very popular, best-selling author, and she's going to talk about her experience in prison and how she transformed her life. So two great shows, and I might also add that we've got a great lineup coming in the new year. We've got three mob shows. Mm-hmm. We got the woman who took down Victor Bout, who is the Pablo Escobar of arms trafficking.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got the cop that investigated Tupac's murder.
Yep.
And so that's going to be, you know, it's going to be a really interesting show. So we got an exciting lineup, and we hope our listeners stay with us next year. As far as what we're doing, Strategic Media Books got a couple of interesting books coming out.
Mm-hmm.
One on a book called Scapegoat at the turn of the beginning of the year. It's going to be very interesting about a death penalty case in California.
Mm-hmm.
Willie?
Well, that's great, Ronnie. Good luck on that side. I'm sure it's going to be a great success. Now, I'll tell you, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, December 19, 2011, New York City. One in three American teens and young adults get arrested by the age of 23. Hey, Ronnie, according to a new study, more American teens are being booked now than in the turbulent 1960s. The arrests are from everything from underage drinking and petty theft to violent crime. Hey, Ronnie, this is overloading the justice system.
Well,
isn't
that amazing? Because we had an earlier show where we pointed out that as many as 64 million Americans have arrest records.
Yeah.
And how hard it was for them to get jobs. So it's really a staggering statistic. And the vast majority of kids will never be arrested again, according to the researchers that were doing this study. You ever been arrested, Willie?
Well, hey, Ronnie, I tell you, I got a little bit of a secret to tell you. Remember the Bamboo Gardens, the restaurant downtown of Thunder Bay?
Oh, yeah.
And it was a place where you used to stand around and ogle the girls.
Yeah, when we were hoodlums, right, growing up.
We'd hang around and watch the cross crews around the block who wanted to pick up these hot chicks. Well, this night, there was a burly cop standing on the corner. He's watching the proceedings, and being a wise guy kid of 19, I stood off the curb and yelled, "Draw!" like a gunslinger on Gunsmoke. Well, this cop, I'll tell you, man, didn't like that too much. He came after me like a crazed rhino, grabbed me by the collar along with my buddy Johnny standing behind me, and declared, "You're under arrest for disturbing the peace." He literally dragged us to the police station and booked us. I spent the night in jail. I felt like the Count of Monte Cristo.
Well, did your father find out? Because, you know, that's one of the reasons why I always stayed out of jail, because, you know, we didn't have timeouts in those days. We had the strap.
Well, good thing my old man never found out. God bless him. But needless to say, I will always remember that experience, let me tell you.
But this is a serious problem. I mean, that's unbelievable, the number of young kids like that, and hopefully, you know, something could be done about it.
Absolutely. Now, let's get on to rap sheet item number two. Dateline, December 18th, 2011. Paris, France. France sentences Carlos the Jackal to another life term. Hey, Ronnie, Carlos the Jackal, the Cold War warrior, international terrorist, and once the world's most wanted man, was handed a second life sentence by a Paris court Thursday after being convicted of masterminding a series of bombings in France 30 years ago. Hey, Ronnie, this guy's going to, he's not going to see the light of day for
right,
a long time.
Right, as if he needed another one. I bet you a lot of our listeners don't even know who the hell Carlos is, you know, but he it's a real blast from the Cold War past. He was probably the symbol of Cold War, terrorism. And I did some background reading, and the trial was really amazing. He spoke 5 hours, a la Fidel Castro, and railing against the capitalist system, against Western society, praising bin Laden, praising Saddam Hussein. He even got a letter from Hugo Chavez in support of his. But I don't think that helped him too much. But anyways, he's unrepentant, and he's living in total isolation. He was more of a debauched revolutionary than he was an actual true faith revolutionary. He was known for his sex orgies. and really, that's what got him kicked out of Sudan and picked up by the French, and that's what led to his downfall.
Well, so, I hope they feed him better than bread and water. They do a lot of time.
Yeah, well, he's gonna eat a lot of bread and water. I'll tell you, he's there for good.
Well, Ronnie, that's a great story. We'll take a brief station identification before we get on to our featured guest. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chapsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie Boy, tonight's featured and very, very special guest is Louis Ferrante. Ferrante was a Gambino crime family associate who used his cunning and innate instincts to pull off some of the biggest heists in U.S. history. After being arrested and serving an 8.5-year sentence in the slammer, Ferrante went straight. In his groundbreaking blockbuster best-selling book titled Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman, the former gangster offers valuable business lessons that will surprise you. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Louis Ferrante.
Hey, thanks, Ron. Thanks for having me tonight.
Hey, man, I'm telling you, just getting on your website was an inspiration, knowing what I know about your past. Did you ever pinch yourself sometimes and say, God, is this life? I mean, knowing where you came from and where you are now, you know, in England, with the wife of the prime minister, honoring you. We'll talk about that a little later. Uh-huh. I mean, do you ever pinch yourself? I mean, and say, God, I'm one lucky dude.
I feel fortunate. It's been a long road. I guess I probably should pinch myself more, and remind myself more from where I came from. Thank you, Ron.
Right. Well, you're welcome. And let's talk about your background so our listeners can understand what an amazing story your story is. You were in trouble from a very young age, right, as a kid growing up in Queens?
Yeah. I guess I probably should take you all the way back to when I was a kid around 13, maybe even 12. I mean, jumping into stolen cars and stuff in the neighborhood, mischief. Eventually turned into theft. We would joyride at first. Guys, older guys would pull up 16, 17 with cars. We'd hop in. We started stealing the cars ourselves, sell the radio, sell the battery, sell the tires. Eventually, body shops in the neighborhood, in the area, the auto body shops would say, we've got a nice car there. We'll take the nose. We'll take the bumper or whatever. And can you get us some parts? And before you know it, I was running a chop shop before I even had a license to drive. And I would eventually have several thieves robbing the cars for me, and then I'd chop them up and deliver them to the shops. Right. And the auto body shops save on the parts. So, usually if, for example, they make 10 grand on a car that was hit, they might make 5 parts, 5 labor. If they're getting the parts from me for a G-note, they save another 4,000, put that in their pocket, and might make 9. So it was worth it for them. I did that for a while, and then eventually hijacked my first truck.
So you weren't going to school too much, but you were improving your math skills, right? You're improving your math skills.
My math was on the money. My math was spot on.
But you know, you're an entrepreneur from a very young age. You know, I mean it's nothing new for you what you're doing today. I mean, you had great preparation.
It was when I started to write the business book, I realized that even from when I had the chop shop, when I was stealing cars, I immediately realized that if I could get guys to steal cars for me and put six or eight thieves on the street in one night, I could produce six or eight more cars than I would do alone.
Right.
I guess I did enterprise young, right, and not even realizing it.
Right. Well, did you know you became an associate of the Gambino? Did they sort of discover you, or how did you hook up with the Gambinos?
Yeah, in Queens, if you're born into that life, which most of my friends were, they either you get inherited by your uncle takes you on, or your cousin, or your grandfather, or your father, whoever's in that family. There's five families in New York.
Right.
The Gambino family is one of them, the Colombo, the Lucchese, the Bonanno, and the Genovese are the other ones. But if you have somebody in your immediate family that's from one of those families, they just usually school you in their life, and they bring you in, and that's the family you belong to. Once in a while, there's an exception. I had a friend who's serving life now. His father was a Genovese guy, and he ended up in the Gambinos because he had a problem, and his uncle, who was a Gambino, straightened the problem out for him and then took him in. But myself, I was like a cowboy. I didn't belong to any particular family. My family, my blood family was not mafia, so I was sort of like a free agent. I could end up with anybody. And I started to, you meet one mob guy after another. When I started hijacking trucks, I got into the big leagues, and I had to use a fence to get rid of the goods, and then the fences that I was dealing with were on the fringe, and I would meet mob guys through them. And one thing led to another, and I ended up trusting a guy in the Gambino family who took me in, and he trusted me, and that's how I ended up in that family.
Right. Well, when you say heists, that's an understatement, right? Because some of those heists were really big jobs.
We did everything from, without giving particulars other than what I was indicted for.
Right.
I was indicted for hijackings and different heists, but without particulars. If somebody, for example, let's say you, Ron, came to me and you work for a company and says, gee, Lou, Friday night from 5 to 7 o'clock, there's $500,000 in the safe because we do payroll and et cetera. And, if you want, there's three guards downstairs, there's a parking lot, there's a door, I go through the whole thing with you, and then I pick the guys in my crew to do whatever they might do best, and then we knock off the place, and then give the tip guy his percentage, and I kick a piece upstairs so the family gets their share, and that's how I operated. That's basically what I did when I was older. In my early 20s, I had a crew of all guys in their 40s, a couple of guys were in their 50s, and the stool pigeon who eventually went bad on me, I think he was in his 50s when he went sour.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting because you were with the Gambinos during the Paul Castellano period, right?
After the Castellano, when Castellano got killed, I was still running a chop shop. I wasn't in the mob yet.
Okay.
I started to come around. It was sort of ambition, sort of a geographical accident that I ended up. Right where Power Central was for the Gambino family, when John Gotti, who was the probably most famous Don of the 20th century besides Al Capone, when he took over the family, he killed Castellano and he took the power from Brooklyn and Staten Island and shifted it over to Queens where his headquarters was, and it was sort of like I said, a geographical accident for me because that was my hunting grounds. So I was smack in the middle of Gambino Central. And so one thing led to another, and I ended up answering directly to the heads of my family. The guys who ran the family, who basically ran New York at the time, were guys that I saw every day, hobnobbed with all day, played cards with at night. So sort of ambition, I rose up to be able to associate with these people and call them my daily colleagues, but also part geographical accident.
Right.
If Power was still in Brooklyn or Staten Island, I probably never would have answered to the heads of my family or even met them.
Right. Well, we all know who John Gotti is because he had such a penchant for publicity, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Which, talking to mob rules, is that a good thing? You know, when you talk
it's
about
not,
what
no.
what we can learn from the mafia, is that one of the things we should learn?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I use it when I translate it into business terms. I say that, you know, if you're a middle manager and you're loud and you're pompous and you're vain and, you know, and you flaunt your stuff, you know, the people, the bosses will put up with you as long as you're turning out the numbers. But as soon as you're in a slump, you're a goner. And what happened with John was, and I was a victim of it myself and guilty of it also. Mm-hmm. John set the precedence for our family. For example, the Genovese family, I was very close friends with Chin Giganti, was the Genovese Don at the time. And his family was very, very close with me. I'm still best friends with the daughter for 25 years. Mm-hmm. He set the precedence for his family. They were very low key, very quiet. They didn't flaunt their money. He didn't flaunt his power. John set the precedence for the Gambino family. He was loud. Very showy, and we were all like that. I mean, I never paid taxes, never had a job. I was wearing a $50,000 watch, driving a $100,000 car. Right. If you were in the Genovese family, you ended up in the trunk of that car. Mm. But John's family, because he allowed it, you know, they just nodded. Nobody told you, what are you doing with this?
But
I was part of it, too. Right.
What's really interesting, along the way to prison, you created a rap music video, which you defended Gambino crime boss John Gotti, and that was blowback, right? Because I didn't really help you.
No.
Talk about that. What happened there?
In the UK, the Guardian newspaper just ran a nice article about that whole rap story, believe it or not, about a week ago. Uh-huh. And I relived it recently, so it's really fresh in my mind. It's nice that you asked that. I get subpoenaed by the FBI. And I'm under indictment. I eventually had three indictments, the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Nassau County Organized Crime Task Force. And I was facing the rest of my life in prison. And I'm out on two bails. And I said, you know, I'm a goner. And the agents were following me regularly. What am I supposed to do now? So what happened was, I'll call him Big Paulie because I don't mention names. I never ratted. I did my time. And I changed names in my first book, my memoir. I changed names. My business book, I only speak of names if the guy's dead, in jail, or ratted already. But anyway, I'll call the guy Big Paulie. Big Paulie said he had a meeting with Mickey Rourke, flew in, and had mentioned to him at dinner that he wanted to have this rap group in California sing a song about how John was railroaded. And John was just sent away not too long before that. And I said, you know, I'm done. I'm a goner. You know, forget about the mob. I'm going to be living the mob in my cell. I may as well take a shot at this and see if I could, you know, put up a defense. So what I did was, I said, let me do the song. And I think he thought I meant produce it. I don't think he thought I meant that I would sing it. And Fat George, a friend of mine, was the caretaker of John Gotti's social club in Queens. And he'd always make, like, rhyming pranks and stuff. So I didn't know how to write a song. So I went to him, and I said, can you do me a favor? Can you write a song about how John got railroaded, and I'm going to take it from there? He said, sure. A couple days later, he called me up from the club. He said, stop by the club in Ozone Park. And he was working that night. I think John had just left. And I went over there, and he gave me the lyrics. And I said, all right, great. I went and got in touch with a famous rapper at the time named Pete Nice. And I sort of made him an offer he can't refuse. We met at Peter Luger's. And I told him, listen, I says, I want to do a rap thing. I want you to teach me how to sing and get me into a studio. And he says, no problem. And he had platinum albums at the time. He had, you know, mainstream, his stuff hit mainstream and went platinum, a couple of his albums. And so anyway, he did that. And then what I did was, once this song took off, I went and I hired William Kunstler, who was a radical civil rights attorney. I don't know if you must remember him, Ron.
I interviewed him.
I hired Kunstler, and Kunstler had represented Gotti on appeals and stuff at the time. And I said, you know, I ended up getting close with him. Bill, I said, here's my defense. I'm probably facing the rest of my life. He says, you definitely are. And I said, I need to try to see if I could get out of this somehow. And my defense ended up being that I sang a song about how John Gotti got railroaded, and the song was played on all the radio stations. It sold all over the place. And now the FBI is coming after me, you know, appropriately. And it was a ridiculous defense, but when you draw, you know, you're grasping at straws and you're sinking in quicksand, and I'm facing the rest of my life behind bars, and ratting is not an option. There's no way I was going to rat.
Right.
If I had to die in jail, I would. I believed in death before dishonor.
Right.
So that's how it happened. The judge didn't allow it in, by the way.
That's really a fascinating story. And like you said, you believe in death before dishonor.
I did.
So what do you think of all the dishonor that's going on in the mafia today, where you have
well,
godfathers, you know, testifying against their own people? what do you think of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's despicable, and I started to see it years ago when I got locked up. I went to prison in 1994, and that was shortly after Sammy went bad. And I was one of the first guys to hear Sammy went bad because John's brother had mentioned it. I was there.
And, of course, we're talking about Sammy Gravano.
Yeah, when Sammy Gravano, the underboss of the Gambino family, went bad. At first, I didn't believe it, Ron. That's how much I believed in the life. I said, there's no way.
Right.
I said, my answer was, he's going to do, and I talk about this in my book, he's going to do the Frankie Five Angels, I said. And the Frankie Five Angels, what I was referring to, and you'll know, is when Frankie Pantangelo in the movie The Godfather said, oh, I said Michael Corleone this, I said Michael Corleone that, but I didn't mean it. And he kind of takes the hit, and Corleone goes free. Well, I thought Sammy was going to rat, because I believed in that life so much that I would do it for my boss.
Right.
I thought Sammy was going to get on the stand and then at the last minute blow the whole
save your hide.
Yeah, save John and say, hey, all right, I sacrificed myself. You know, once he got in front of the jury, he was going to say, oh, I don't remember nothing. John was always innocent, and double-cross the government. Right. Well, sure enough, I didn't know the power of self-preservation. And he really was ratting. And then after that, I went to prison, and I faced life in the can, and time after time, capos, underbosses, consigliers were getting locked up, and they're going bad. And I'm saying, I can't believe these guys. They're crying. You know, I'd be in a dormitory with 125 guys, and there's 30 or 40 mobsters. And I got a guy who ran maybe Brooklyn or the Bronx, and he's sitting next to me crying, going, I can't believe they're going to do this to me. What do you mean you can't believe it? You've been a wise guy for 30 years. Now you can't believe it? Yeah, I mean, you got to be kidding me. Right. Pay the piper, buddy.
Right.
So I kind of knew what was coming.
Right.
And that, you know, helped me make part of my decision as to this I'm not going anywhere in this life, other than the moral things that I questioned eventually.
Yeah, Ronnie,
before you go on, I was going to follow up with a question.
You
talk about the importance of loyalty in your book, right? So how did the mob treat you? Because you were a stand-up guy. You know, you kept your mouth shut. Mm-hmm. You know, you went to jail. You served your time. Did they treat you the way they were supposed to treat you? When you're in prison, they take care, you know, the kids, care of your family,
yes,
and all that
no.
sort of stuff.
I'm gonna break norm, and I'm gonna say a real name to compliment somebody.
Right.
Joe Watts, Joe the German, they called him, although he wasn't German, but they called him Joe the German. He's suspected of being one of the shooters at the Castellano hit when John took over the family. Mm-hmm. Joe Watts was the classiest guy I ever met in the world. And he was one of the guys, when I was in the can, I spent a few $100,000 on lawyers trying to fight for my life. I went through 7 attorneys after Kunstler before I ended up studying law and representing myself and reversing one of my cases.
Yeah.
But anyway, make a long story short, Joe Watts, who was a Gambino guy, came over to me, and he says, I got a good lawyer for you. And he had his lawyer come up to see me. And I said, I'm going to hire the guy. And I told the guy, I go, you got to meet my friends on the street. Mm-hmm. They'll take care of you. And he says, I'm taken care of already. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, Joe Watts took care of me already. I'm representing you. So, I mean, so once in a while you got a guy. I mean, Joe Watts was one of the generous, classiest mobsters I ever met in my life. But once in a while you got a guy who personally reached out and helped you. And that happened time and again. Another guy was in the Bonanno family. He came through for me. He was a friend of mine since I was a kid. He ended up becoming a capo in the Bonanno family.
Mm-hmm.
He reached out and helped me. But it's no longer something where the family does it like they don't
automatic.
Have a treasure. No, they don't have a treasure chest, you know, a coffer,
and they
send your family money and you, and that doesn't happen anymore. You're on your own nowadays.
Right.
You might get a personal guy who says, gee, you know, Louis was a good guy. I'm going to stick up, you know, I'm going to cough up some money for his family or for him.
Right.
That happens, yeah.
Right. You're on your own. That's America, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I hate to say it.
You
that's the news. Yeah, in the mob, too. Young generation,
right? Willie, ask Louis your question, please.
Yeah. Louis, I got a quick question for you.
Yeah, you got
With Omerta, is like it's a term like it's disappearing. A lot of people, a lot of these big dons are singing like canaries. Are we seeing the dying embers of the mafia? How strong?
Yeah, I think it's on its last dying breath. I'll give you a perfect example. I left the mob in jail, and there was a number of things that made that drew me away from it. Eventually, leading up to me questioning, you know, the whole do I have a right to stick a gun in somebody's mouth? Of course not. I mean, you know, but when I was ignorant, I couldn't see it in those terms. But I eventually did. But when I first started to question it, all the rats were saying, I was saying to myself, where are we going with this thing? And here's a perfect example. A guy in the Bonanno family who did reach out for me and help me out when I was in the can said, when you come out, I want to try to get you released and you know, he was close. Joe Massino was the boss of the Bonanno family at the time. And I knew Joe. I said hello to Joe now and then in the neighborhood. Never did any criminal activity with Joe. But Joe Massino was the boss, and if you saw him, you said hello. You were respectful to him. In Howard Beach he lived, by the way. He lived a few blocks away from John Gotti's house. So anyway, make a long story short, had I come home from prison and got straightened out in the Bonanno family, within a year after that, Joe Massino, the actual boss of the Bonanno family, who would have straightened me out, became a rat. So my own boss would have put me back in jail.
Right.
So, I mean, once the boss is a rat, what's left?
Yeah. Right, that's
I mean,
right.
You know, what the hell is left? There's really, you know, a chain is as strong as its weakest link. We all know that.
Right.
Well, this is the whole darn fence.
Right, that's right. And, Willie, let's take a break, a station break. Fascinating interview with Lou Perrante, author of Mob Rules. Go ahead, Willie.
Great, great guest, great interview. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Our special guest is Louis Ferrante, author of Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. Now back to Ron and Mr. Ferrante.
Yes, and we're back with Louis Ferrante, and he's also done another book called Unlocked, A Journey from Prison to Proust. Louis, can you tell us the title in England? It's a different title for our listeners in England. They may want to get a copy of the book.
Yeah, also, too, that was actually the hardcover title. The title in America is Unlocked, The Life and Crimes of a Mafia Insider. And England picked up the book, and they distributed it throughout the Commonwealth countries, so it made its way around Europe. They put it in the airports, and it was called Tough Guy in Europe. And Tough Guy did pretty well in Europe. And I got a lot of, I did a couple of book tours over there, which was great. And the Unlocked, which is what it's called in America, was translated into Dutch, and the UK picked it up. But Mob Rules has had already a tremendous amount more of success. It's being translated into, it's in 12 languages right now as we speak, which is awesome.
Right. We got listeners around the world, so I'm pretty sure they're excited about that. And you've got a website, www.louisferrante.com, a very attractive website, I might add. And I encourage our listeners to go to it. And I know you're on Facebook, too. So our listeners that are on Facebook, which is pretty well the whole world, can go to Facebook and hook up with Louis there on that. Louis, getting back to our interview, did you ever read a book before you went to prison?
I never read a book from cover to cover in my life. I did graduate high school. I was literate. I knew how to read. My mother begged me to graduate high school because her brother was a junkie and a felon. And he died about a year ago, actually. My mother died young. My mother died when I was 20. But he put them through hell. He was a hijacker, actually, too, which is interesting.
Right.
It must have been in my blood. But he stood up, by the way, as even though he was a junkie. He went to jail and did his time every time. But anyway, my mother used to say, please go to school. Mm-hmm. My family didn't go to school. Me and your father never went to school. That's why we struggle. Please graduate high school at least. You can't do anything without. So just for her, I loved her. I went to high school and I graduated. But I cheated my way. Somebody did my homework. Another person did my projects. I paid to get things done. I got through probably with a C or D average or whatever.
Right.
And I made it through. So I knew how to read. I was literate, but I never read a book. I picked up my first book. Yeah.
So how did you become a literary man and a man that appreciate great literature?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, and I've read thousands and thousands of books now. So here's how it happened in a nutshell. I'm in the hole. I'm in the can now.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up copping out to 13 years. I pled guilty, kept my mouth shut, serving my time. I went to the maximum security prison, Lewisburg Penitentiary. I was there when there were murders. It was a place that was like hell on earth. But anyway, I was getting into fights now and then, not in the max. The max is do or die. There's no fist fights in the max, just knife fights and somebody drops. But before I went to the max, when I was still in the holdover, I'd get into a fist fight with somebody, go to the hole. I was still a hot-headed kid off the street. And one of the trips to the hole wasn't for something I did. Somebody else did something. I got pinched. Somebody threw an apple at the cop, the hack.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke apart in his eye, and the hack, because the older guy was an older guy, he figured I did it. So, you know, because he knew the direction it came from, but he didn't see who did it. So they locked me up in the hole. And I'm in the hole, and I had confrontation with the guard in the hole, because they thought that I assaulted another guard, and I didn't.
Right.
But they says, well, if it wasn't you, who was it? I told them to go F themselves, go find out who it was for themselves. And eventually, the guy was crouched down next to my food slot. There's a food slot in the door of the hole in the solitary confinement cell. And we had words together, and I went to grab his tie, and I pulled it off his neck. I wanted to strangle him. I didn't know what to pull off his neck. And I said, it's a clip on you, you dirty bastard. And I threw the tie back at him. And you know, he looked at me through the reinforced glass, which is above the food slot, and he looked at me, and he says, you think we'd wear real ties with you animals in here? He says, that's all you are, is an animal. You're in a zoo. And he says, and as if the prison isn't good enough for you, you got to be in another hole, a smaller prison inside of a prison. So he was right. I got out of the hole. I called my friend. I had a lot of questions. I started to think about my life. I got out of the hole, and I called my friend Fat George, who I mentioned earlier. And Fat George was about 400 pounds, and he was the caretaker of John Gotti's club.
Right.
And he had biblical verses tattooed on his body. And I says, hey, Fatso, I says, you ever read books? He says, sure. I says, I read the Bible. I read a couple other books. I says, can you send me books? What do you want? I said, I have no idea. I never read a book in my life. Go to the store. Tell the broad about me. Maybe the salesperson's got some. I don't mean to disrespect your female listeners today. That was my talk back then, Ron.
Right.
So I says, yeah, tell the broad at the store. I said, you know, whatever. And he sends me. About a week later, I get a package in the mail. Napoleon by Vincent Cronin, Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, and Caesar's Gaelic Wars. So what the frig is this? So I called him up. I says, hey, Fatso, what'd you send me? He says, I did what you said. I went to the store. I told the broad all about you. And this is, what'd you tell her? He says, I told her you're short and bossy. With that, she pulled off these books. Books off the shelf. So he sent me three dictators. So now I read the books. Believe it or not, I read them. I got through them, but I knew nothing of what I read. I did not understand anything about the National Socialist Party,
right,
or Revolutionary France, or why Caesar was even in Gaul, or where Gaul was.
Right.
So anyway, I did push through it, though, and I studied my vocabulary words. I would write down every word. I wouldn't just pass over a word, and I would learn each word. I bought a dictionary in the can for a stamp. I think it was missing X, Y, and Z. It was like a half a dictionary. And whatever words I could look up, I did. And then I started to, you know, the guys in the can started to say, gee, you know, you really like these books. And I started really reading. And then my family and friends kept sending me books, and I fell in love with reading. Eventually, I'd read a book a day. And then I also picked up the pen eventually and started to write. Somebody could do what I could.
Right. We could tell you've got storytelling skills, but the thing that I thought was kind of funny was that you decided to become a writer, and your first effort was a 1,200-page novel about
antebellum.
So are you trying to be? You're trying to be Marty Mitchell?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, War and Peace. I said, I used to love, too, the 19th century. I read a lot of biographies, a lot of history, but if I read fiction, it was 19th century fiction, stuff that withstood the test of time.
Right.
So I would read, like, Victor Hugo or Leo Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or the Bronte sisters, and they were always these long, flowery novels, but they had a moral message, too, and I needed a moral compass at the time. So I was reading these books, and they would give me moral messages. You know, Les Mis is nothing but 1,500 or 2,000 pages, whatever it is, of moral lessons about society.
So
anyway, I'm reading these, and that's the first thing that I wanted to do, was write like these masters, not knowing I wasn't a master. I was just a convict in prison. But I wrote this 1,200-page novel, like you said, and came home from prison. And I wrote it about the antebellum South, it starts in the 1830s, it goes up and through the Civil War. And I read history about the Civil War, Lee, Jackson, Grant, McClellan, etc. So I knew the times a little. And I wrote this novel, and believe it or not, everywhere I went, nobody wanted to even read it, because what the hell is an Italian guy writing about the slave South from jail? So Italian guy from jail. So I was an ex-mobster writing about the antebellum South.
Right.
But believe it or not, I recently cut it down to 400 pages. So I hope to publish it one day.
Right, you hope to publish it. Well, my hat's off to you, because your title is From Prison to Proust, and I had to read Proust in college. And I remember Remembrance of Things Past. You know that opening?
Yeah.
That opening sentence that goes on like the Volga River. You know.
He don't make a period. He goes.
I know.
On four pages.
He didn't believe in periods, right?
No, nothing. Unbelievable.
Yeah. But anyways, you started to read. And by the way, that book has been optioned by Lorraine Bracco, Sopranos, right?
Yeah.
Unlocked.
Unlocked was optioned. I got the option back. What happened was, she optioned it for 12 months. She read Unlocked and loved it. She called me up, and I mean, I knew right away through her, you know, that she's got that real distinct voice.
Right.
Dr. Melfi. And she says, I read the book and I loved it. And I says, oh, really? That's great. She goes, I want to buy the movie. I said, great. And she was just getting off, finishing up The Sopranos and looking for new things to do. And I don't think she realized that it's very tough to produce a direct movie and just, you know, having great acting ability, which she does. She's an amazing actress.
Yes, she is.
Oh, amazing. And she's a brilliant woman, by the way, too. I did spend some time with her, and she's a brilliant woman. I can't and kind as sweet as pie. But again, you know, they did get a dish out $100 million, Hollywood, to a director for a movie, and I don't know if she had the yet. She may have it one day, but at the time, I don't think she was able to do it. So I did get the option back. Maybe one day, who knows, something else will happen. But I'm still writing the book of my life, hopefully. I'm not done yet. So.
Right.
Yeah, I got a quick question for Lewis. Lewis, you were in a pretty tough prison when you were arrested and put in there. You must have got the razz from a lot of these tough guys in there. Anything that you can remember?
I'll tell you about my first day. And, you know, this is why I was able to survive it so well. I was a tough guy through and through. And I was willing to, you know, if it was my honor on the line, as I said before, death before dishonor, that stretched into every realm of my life. If, in other words, a guy, you know, stepped on my foot when I was walking the hallways and said, you know, get out of my way, shorty, you know, that was it. You know, you were going with me. We were going to the death, or you were going to back off and apologize. And what I knew is I had a good psychological evaluation of human nature, and I knew that anybody who starts a fight with me is a bully, and every bully is a coward. So I had the guy beat right away. I knew I had him beat. All I had to do was stand up to him, and he'd rather go to the next guy. And that's usually what happened. I was fortunate like that. But that's in the 7 or 8 other jails I was in. But there was a maximum security. I was in Lewisburg Penitentiary.
Right.
My very first day in population. And, again, I'll use a name here because it's very benign, the situation. Jimmy Coonan was the Irish boss of the Westies. He was a boss out of Hell's Kitchen. He was. They wrote the book, The Westies, about him. But he was a gem of a guy. I hook up with Coonan as soon as I land in the penitentiary. And we as Italians, because I was with a couple of capos and underboss there, we as Italians treated him as if he was a mafia don. You know, he was a mafia don, an Irish mafia don, but we treated him as if he was an Italian don. We gave him the same respect, and he deserved it. He had a close relationship with Castellano. When Castellano died, he had a close relationship with Gotti. So anyway, Jimmy Coonan introduces me to a few guys on the compound. I meet a few of the Italians that I knew from the streets. They had been locked up. They all had life sentences. I hadn't seen them in 3 or 4 years. I finally saw them and caught up with them. Anyway, I'm walking the yard with Coonan. He introduces me to this guy and tells me, the guy's the head of the Aryan Nation. And the guy tells me, you need anything around here I can help you with, let me know. I said, thanks anyway, I'm good. But, you know, if I bump into you, I'll tell you, if anything, thank you. I go in, they call lockdown. It was whatever darkness was before it got dark in the yard in the penitentiary. They call lock-in, and they make everybody clear the yard, go back to their housing units, cell blocks, rather. So I says, all right, they clear the yard. I go back to my thing. The alarms start going off as soon as I walk in my cell block. I see cops, hacks, running by my cell block with machetes, and I talk about this in my memoir, machetes dripping with blood. What the frig is going on? The Aryans, starting with the guy I was in the yard with, who was as calm and cool as you and I talking right now, they went in, and they had the whole thing all planned out. So I don't know what he was going to do. He thought he was going to get away with this, I guess, because I don't know what he was going to do for me after this. They had the whole thing planned out. They go inside, and your listeners could actually Google this. It was in 1998 in Lewisburg. The Aryan Nation has this whole hit team, and they pass out machetes, and they hack to death and slaughter 2 black Muslims. And they had about 6 they were looking to get, but after 2, the cop walked in on a bloody homicides. These bloody homicides, he pulled the panic button. We used to call it hit the deuces or pull the pin. That's what it is it's basically hitting the alarm on his radio for backup. So we hit the deuces, and the goon squad started, you know, running all over the prison. They locked down the prison, and these Aryans, you know, hacked to death and slaughtered these black Muslims. So that's my very first day in the general population in Lewisburg. So if that's not welcome to the pen, nothing is.
Right. Let's take a break, and we'll go into the last 10 minutes with Lewis Ferrante.
You bet. What a fascinating interview. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First
World Radio Network. Your hosts are Ron Chapsik and yours truly, Will Harib. Now back to Ron and Louis Ferrante.
We're back with Louis Ferrante, and listeners can go to www.louisferrante.com for more information about our special guest. And he's also on Facebook. And briefly, Lou, are there any tips that you could give our listeners to getting your books?
Yeah, perseverance. I mean, are you talking about publishing a book?
No, about buying
your getting
books.
My own book,
my
own.
They're on Amazon, right?
And, they're available everywhere. I mean, unfortunately, though, the whole borders chain closed and bookstores are unfortunately closing.
Right.
So, I mean, the best way is to just go on, log on to Amazon, Louis Ferrante, Mob Rules. In Europe, they say Louis Ferrante. When I visit England, I go to London a lot. They say Louis Ferrante. But basically, just Amazon or any of the internet booksellers.
Right.
If you put in my name, you could also go to my website, louisferrante.com, as you said, louisferrante.com.
Okay.
And that's the best way to get it. Thank
great. Now, in your book, you write that you call the mafia the longest running corporation in history. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it thrives along with other companies during prosperous times and flourishes even more in periods of economic decline. Bear of wool makes no difference to the mafia. Can you explain what you meant by that? And why?
I can. Some of the better businessmen I met in the mafia, and some of these guys did not rat, which is interesting. They went away. They caught a bid eventually. And they did not rat. And I won't mention their names. They may still be active in the life. But some of the best businessmen I met, worth tens of millions, some of them worth in the hundreds of millions. They were really, really just really savvy street guys who applied their street smarts to legitimate business.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, I mean, the mafia is this chain, you know, this pyramid, rather, and you have to claw your way to the top. And that's no different from a corporation. It's no different from government service. You know, anything you're involved in, human nature is constant. It's always the same.
Right.
Now, the mafia may use violence. You know, they may kill to get rid of their enemies. But that's really, believe it or not, for all the violence that people think the mafia is guilty of, it's a fraction of all the disputes that are brought to the table every day. Only the smallest percentage you could ever imagine really result in violence.
Right.
We used to have sit-downs over everything. If a guy robbed me over $1 million, I had to take it to the table. I couldn't just go kill the guy.
Right.
You needed permission to kill somebody. And first you had to exhaust all the avenues. You had to go to a sit-down. If you couldn't resolve it, you had to go back to your skipper, and then his skipper would meet your skipper, and they would have a sit-down.
Right.
And then if they couldn't resolve it, maybe the bosses, if it was worthy. They're like the Supreme Court. They get involved. You know, I mean, it's so there's all these stages were set up within the mafia to really prevent violence. So take away the violence and just weigh the measure of man or woman, you know, the instincts we have to get ahead.
Right.
It's the same exact stuff.
Well, that's what you point out. You trust your instincts, right?
Yeah, all the time. And I'll tell you what, Ron, I fared better in the mob at times, because if I shook on something, that was the end of it. I could do, if there was $250,000 between me and you, Ron, you had to pay me Friday, and I shook on it, or you shook on it with me, rather. That money was there. If I owed it to you, it was there. Now you need a battery of attorneys to seal that contract, and then Friday comes, and the guy's got a story for you.
Right.
So, I mean, that's real life. That's business.
Right.
You know, and then he wants to pay you a fraction of it, or then it might be worth it for him to go out of business and start his company up in another name just so he could screw you. I mean, these are the things that happen under the umbrella of the law.
Right. Well, if one of our listeners was a small businessman, and you had an opportunity to talk to you, and he said, what are three things that you would stress from your years in the mafia that I can learn to be better at what I do?
Okay, now I don't know if we'll break down into three things, but I'll give you it in a nutshell, and it's priceless advice. On the street, everything is your word. That's your verbal resume that follows you everywhere you go. And who you are is something that you can't get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And either you're a deadbeat, you're a punk, you're no good, or you're an honorable guy, and anyone would do business with you, anybody will give you money. And, you know, I could borrow $1 million when I was on the street. So what's your word? Integrity. That's really what it was all about, the mob, before it fell apart. Integrity, honor, these are things that you should take as a small businessman and cherish. And if you are, you know, you treat your people good. For all the mob's BS, they people dealt with us every day. Legitimate people dealt with us every day. I never met a legitimate person who didn't love me. They all wrote me letters when I was in the can. Why? I treated them like gold.
Right.
You know, you treat people, and it comes back to you, the same thing. And if you're a small businessman, you have to treat people right, and you always remember honor and integrity. If you give your word, keep it.
Right. Now, what about some of these really high-profile business leaders? Would they make it in the mafia's godfather? For example, we're seeing too much of Donald Trump lately. He's everywhere. What do you think of him? I mean, his management style.
Yeah.
Would that succeed in the mafia?
Yes and no. I happen to like the guy. I think he's okay. Would he succeed in the mafia? He's got the you know, the same primitive instincts for power and money that top mobsters do have.
Right.
So in that sense, yeah, you know, he's always survived. He's gone bankrupt and come out of it again. So he's a survivor, the guy.
Right.
So he's got the right instincts and stuff. You know, it's a different world. I don't know if he's, you know, he might say you're fired on his show to somebody, and he's gloating that he threw somebody out of the room because it makes him feel good. But when you got to pull the trigger and it's somebody's life, it's a little bit different. So who knows if he's got the, you know, the stuff to do that.
Well, one of the things that I don't like about him, he's thin-skinned. He can't take. He always got to come back quickly. What advice would you give to him, you know, if he came to you and he said, you know, I read your book, I think it's really great, and I'm overwhelmed with all the good information you got. How can I improve my act?
That's Trump's flaw, what you just said, and it's a big flaw, and you can't be like that. That Rosie O'Donnell ran circles around him because he was thin-skinned.
Right.
You know, he let this woman who he was warring with really, really abuse him because of his thin skin.
That's right.
I agree with you. You know, he's got to let it run off.
Right.
He would have looked like more of a man if he just took it in stride, laughed, and said it's funny, and then went on. Every time he tried to jab back at her, he made himself look foolish.
That's right.
I totally agree with that. So I would tell him, hey, listen, you know, take it on the chin.
Right.
You know, mobsters take it on the chin all day.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's part of life.
Right. Well, how about the kinder, gentler capitalist, Warren Buffett, you know, who has a different, completely different, you know, management style, and he's, you know, likable and all that. Would that style work in
I'll tell
office?
You right now. I'll tell you a story, an interesting story, too, that you'll like, Ron, your listeners, hopefully, too. When I used to the Chin's youngest daughter, who's my dear friend, when I used to stay at a house once in a while on the weekend, and I would drop her off in the morning, her and her mom, the Chin's wife, who beautiful people.
Mm-hmm.
I used to drop them off at the GW Bridge. At the time, they were living in Jersey, and he lived with his 90-something-year-old mother in the city where he ran the Genovese family from the little apartment. And I would drop her off at the GW Bridge, and this little old guy, Bruce, who was as humble and modest as a Warren Buffett. I'm coming around to the point of this story, and I'll tell you, it's an interesting story. This little guy, Bruce, would get out of an old, beat-up Buick, and I understand that Warren Buffett drives the same Cadillac he's been driving for like 20 years now, and he would get out of this old little car and had white wool tires, and he, you know, the guy was dressed like, you know, he looked like he needed a hot soup and $5. And I would say, hey, how you doing? And he would shake my hand like, you know, no strength in his handshake. And he was and he'd get behind the wheel, and he could barely see over the dashboard, and he'd wave to me. And he'd drive away with the Chin's wife and his daughter and take them into the city. I always imagined, because I didn't know all the Chin's guys. I knew the Gambino guys. I met wise guys from the Genovese crew on the street now and then, but I didn't know every one of his guys. I imagined that he was just the guy he got from the neighborhood who was a driver and picked up his wife and kid, and that's it. Well, years later, I'm in the can, and it says trusted capo and close confidant of Genovese boss, Vincent Chin Gigante, Bruce Palmieri, dies of natural causes. And I says, whoa, that's Bruce. This guy was one of his most trusted, street smart, treacherous, if he had to be, capos in the family. And you would have never known it. And that's a Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett comes across as this humble old man who sits in a chair, and he's ha 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 yeah, yeah. And meanwhile, this guy, you know, I mean, if there's millions on the line, I'm sure he's ready to cut your throat for it. He didn't get rich by accident.
Right.
You know, you don't sit there at the bingo club, which is what he looks like he would be doing all day.
Was that the way Lucky Luciano operated? Because I for some reason I have this sort of connection with Luciano and Warren Buffett for some reason.
I'll tell you, I think maybe like a Meyer Lansky.
Oh, Meyer Lansky.
Yeah, who was tight with Luciano. Meyer Lansky.
Probably better, right?
Yeah, I think Meyer Lansky was like that, you know, low-key.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, if Meyer Lansky, actually, if you told Meyer Lansky, you know, and I recently, doing research for my book, Mob Rules, I read about the old-time gangsters. Believe it or not, as contemporary gangsters, we didn't know the history of gangsters.
Right.
You know, John Gotti didn't know the history of Luciano or Lansky. He might have heard about them.
Right.
But anyway, if you said to Meyer Lansky, I heard you were $300 million, he got offended. Yeah, he didn't want nobody talking about that. He was quiet. He was low-key. Sort of like a Warren Buffett, I guess.
Well, we got about 20 seconds left, and we should have another couple hours. We're just starting to warm up here. But one last question. Can you answer in about 20 seconds? Are they going to knight you and start calling you Sir Lou because of your relationship with England? Tell briefly about your relationship with the Prime Minister, former Prime Minister.
I was getting a lot of requests after my book tours to go there and visit prisons and visit youths at risk of offending. I did some work with the Prince's Trust, and I would go there, you know, voluntarily, and work with anybody who needed help at the time. And eventually, I get a phone call from the Prime Minister's office, and they said, "We're having you at Downing Street, and we're giving you an award." And I said, "You got to be kidding me!" Now, I've read about every Prime Minister in England, from Lloyd George, Neville Chamberlain, Pitt the Elder, Pitt the Younger, Churchill, etc., Clement Attlee. So when I walked up the Prime Minister's staircase and saw all the pictures of these Prime Ministers, and then sat in the chair where they sat, to me, coming from a cockroach-infested prison cell where people were getting hacked to death, It was quite a journey. So I don't know if I'm going to get knighted, though. I don't know if they're that crazy yet.
Sir Lou, thank you so much. We're going to have to cut it off here, unfortunately, and we'll invite you back on the show. Keep us informed what you're doing, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you as well, Ron, and thank you, Willie, and I wish you guys both a happy holiday, and to your listeners as well.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm sure they're going to go out and buy Mob Rules. Willie?
Yeah, same to you, Lewis. All the best for the holiday season and a very happy new year. Well,
great, thank
Ronnie,
you.
Wow, what a great interview. What a great show. We needed 3 hours with Lewis.
Right.
You know, what did you learn about the program tonight?
Well, I learned that Lou Ferrante is a really amazing, amazing guy and a real inspiration. You know, being a writer myself, when I hear guys like this, the adrenaline starts flowing. And I just think that he's, you know, just getting started.
You bet.
I mean, you know, he's only been out since 2003.
Yeah.
And look what he's done so far. So we wish him the best in the future. What about you, Willie?
Well, I think he's only 43 years old, so he's got a lot of good future ahead of him. Well, I learned that Lewis hits the nail on the head in all 88 lessons. Yeah. I read the book. It was a great book. I think his book should be standard reading in every business school in the country.
Right.
I'm telling you, this guy knows his stuff. Yeah. He should be the head of the Fed. You should take Bernanke's place. I tell you. Anyway, he's got my vote. Another thing, too, he's got a great story to tell young kids who get into trouble.
Right.
Just goes to prove if Ferrante can do it, so can the ghetto kids. Kudos to him.
But Willie, let's forego the last part, the dumb crook and moving.
Yeah,
we're
gonna. This is gonna be a crime beat, dumb crook of the month segment. Hey, Ronnie, this guy goes.
Let's make it quick because we're running out of
time.
Yeah,
this guy goes in a Wells Fargo bank and he plans to rob it. He's got a deposit slip and he writes on it, "This is a stick up. Put all the money in the bank." Then he stood in line, but he got nervous, thinking that someone might have seen him write the note. So he left the bank and crossed the street to the Bank of America. He waited in line, then handed the note to the teller. After reading the note, the teller determined that the man was not very bright. So he told him he could not accept the stick-up note because it was written on a Wells Fargo deposit slip. You know, he would either have to fill out a Bank of America deposit slip or go back to the Wells Fargo bank. Looking somewhat defeated, the man said okay and returned to the Wells Fargo bank across the street, where he was nabbed while standing in line. What a dumb crook.
I mean, really, really, really dumb. People think I'm making this stuff up. You got to come up with a crook that's a little bit smarter than that. People can start believing our dumb crook section.
Well, what a story. Anyway, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program scheduled for December 29th, where we'll have our special guest, Mr. Tim Donaghy, in a command performance. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. Now, we hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Now, if you want to support our broadcast, please make a contribution to Crime Beat via the Artists First World Radio Network. The address is on the top page for quick reference. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Hrib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Merry Christmas, everybody. Good night, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie, and Merry Christmas to our listeners.